So, tonight's topic, as per the flyer, I put Eastern Rites of the Catholic Church, but I'm going to kind of correct that right away because that's what we tend to call them, but technically the language that we're supposed to use is we're supposed to call them Eastern Churches in the plural. And this can be kind of confusing sometimes because people say, well, I thought there is only one Church of Christ. And that's true, there is one Holy Catholic and Apostolic Church. And as Vatican II reminds us, that subsists in the Catholic Church. So the Catholic Church is the one true church. That being said, there are churches within the church. And it can be kind of confusing to put it that way. But that is the language that the canon law uses, and that's the language that Vatican II especially wanted us to start using to talk about the autonomous churches within the church. And we see some of this even in, in the New Testament where St. Paul talks about, the church of this place or the church of that place. And even sometimes we'll say that to this day. We'll still say, like, oh, the Church of Washington. And we don't mean that as a separate denomination, but what we mean is the Roman Catholic Church in Washington. But sometimes we'll just say it differently. So just a little explanation there in the beginning. They're all part of the one Holy Catholic Apostolic Church over which Pope Benedict XVI reigns supreme, right? So sometimes it can get kind of confusing. Well, someone will say, well, are you Roman Catholic? And they'll say, well, no, I'm not Roman Catholic. I'm Ukrainian Catholic. And they'll say, well, so are you under the Pope? Well, yeah, I recognize the Pope. Well, then you're Roman Catholic. No, I'm not Roman Catholic, And that's kind of the discussion that will happen. So there are people who are under the Pope who are not Roman Catholic. They'll still have the word Catholic in their name, and that's the indication that they are under the Pope. They're not in schism, as some of the other churches are. We're going to get into that in a minute, but that's just to clarify some of the language there, so we talk about the different churches, not just the rites. But to talk about the rites now, because this is kind of just to clear up the language, as Christianity began to spread, as the 12 apostles took the message of Christ to the corners of the world, and founded churches in those different areas, tradition says, for instance, that Peter went to Antioch first and founded the church there, and then went to Rome and founded the church there. And that's why he's considered the first bishop of both of those places. St. Mark, for instance, is said to have gone to Alexandria in Egypt. St. Thomas, the one who doubted Christ, interestingly enough, legend says he went the farthest. He went to India. And that's why even today people will still refer to themselves as Thomas Christians. So that's just an example there, and we could go with through all the apostles, but of course that's kind of how Christianity kind of spread throughout the world. And as we can expect, what happened was in those different areas of the world, different traditions developed, different ways of being Christian. It was all the same faith, but it would be expressed in different ways. The liturgy, of course, is probably the most visible expression of the faith. And so there would be different ways of celebrating the Mass, different ways in which it was done, which continue to this day. But not just the liturgy. Also, even when it comes to sheer theology, just the way in which things were expressed. In Rome, of course, because of the Roman Empire and because of Roman philosophy taking its cue from Greek philosophy, there were certain categories that were used in Roman theology that continue to this day. Whereas in other parts of the world, if you said something like, and this caused certain debates and certain misunderstandings, when you talked about, the nature of Christ, two natures in one person, and that the second person of the Trinity is the same person as Jesus Christ. And when you use categories like nature and person and things like that, sometimes that just completely confused people who aren't used to those categories, who have their own categories, their own ways of thought. So So anyways, it's the same faith, but it's being expressed in different ways, liturgically, theologically, and also as well in terms of discipline and law. So we're going to get into some of those differences as well later on, but those different kinds of traditions developed and the different kind of rites developed. And the reason why we use the word churches and not rites is because you have many churches that are all of the same rite. So originally there were five main patriarchates, as they were called, five big cities of Christendom. Rome was one of them, and they were considered the first among equals. But there was also Constantinople, which is now Istanbul. But before it was Constantinople, named after Constantine, it was Byzantium. So we get the Byzantine rite from Constantinople, from Byzantium. But there was Alexandria as well, Antioch, and Jerusalem. Jerusalem was. So they actually were called the Pentarchy, because the five patriarchates that were the big centers of liturgical life. So again, Rome, Constantinople, Alexandria, Antioch, and Jerusalem. Anyways, so we had all those different traditions developing. And you had many churches coming out of a certain tradition. So, for instance, in the Byzantine rite, you have many different churches. In the Alexandrian rite, you have a few different churches. In the Antiochian rite, you have many churches. So that's that. But then things began to splinter. The churches were all in union around Rome. Rome, the Bishop of Rome, was considered the first among equals. But there began to be some problems, and the first problem was in the year 431 at the Council of Ephesus, and this was where there was a bishop named Nestorius, and the heresy was Nestorianism. And again, this was a confusion of terms here. The Council of Ephesus condemned Nestorianism, which basically said that there were two natures in Christ, but they were completely separate, that his human and divine nature were completely separate. And he was trying to express something, but he didn't use the right language, and there was misunderstandings on both sides. Anyways, he was condemned by the Council of Ephesus. And all of his followers kind of broke off and started their own church, their own outside of the communion of everyone else. And so that was kind of your first big splinter in Christendom. And that's where we get nowadays what we call the Assyrian Church of the East. Very small church, but they're the ones that are the modern-day Nestorians. And again, there is a lot of confusion as to what exactly did they believe. Were they really in heresy, or were they just trying to express what they believed in terminology different from our own? You know, and that seems to be more likely the case now, and that's why a lot of these groups, we're trying to do all sorts of dialogue with them. The second big split happened 20 years later, in 451, and that was at the Council of Chalcedon, and the big split there was people trying to fight against Nestorianism. Nestorianism said there were two natures in Christ, but they were completely separate. And we believe, of course, that there are two natures in Christ, but that they're perfectly united. But people fighting against that extreme fell into the other extreme of saying there was only one nature in Christ, that his human nature was somehow completely taken up into his divine nature such that there was only one nature. And that was called monophysitism. The word physitism, is the Greek for nature. And mono was one nature. That was condemned. And that's where we kind of had the second big break. And those are what we call today the Oriental Orthodox. And even when you hear the word Orthodox today, there are really two types of Orthodox, two big umbrella types of Orthodox. There are many other underneath that. But you have your Eastern Orthodox and your Oriental Orthodox. And the word Oriental means East, and so it can be kind of confusing. But that was one group that kind of broke off after the Council of Chalcedon. Because they were, and again, to this day, we will still sometimes call them the Monophysites, the Monophysitism, the Monophysites. And again, there was still a debate, an issue of did they really believe that, or were they just grasping for a way to express what they believed? But so that group was anathema, right, after the Council of Chalcedon. And those, again, are the Oriental Orthodox. And then in the year 1054, this is where you hear the big Great Schism of 1054. This was the big break between East and West. And some theologians, some historians will talk about the year 1054 as the year that nothing happened, because they say that 1054 was really just, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back, that there had been so much friction that had been building up, principally between the Church of Rome and the Church of Constantinople. And there was some historical debate, too, because when the Roman Empire was moved to Constantinople, there began some issues there of who is really in charge. Is Rome really first among equals, or is Constantinople? And so there was some issue there. The Patriarch of Constantinople referred to himself as the Ecumenical Patriarch, which means, like, of the whole church, and that ticked off the Pope. And the Pope's delegate excommunicated this patriarch, and this patriarch excommunicated them, and they both excommunicated each other. And that was in the year 1054. And that was the big break. That's often what's called the Great Schism. And that's where we have the Orthodox of today, the Eastern Orthodox of today. So again, I've tried to just talk about the three big breaks in the Christian East. Okay, and at this point, the Christian West really, at this point, was just Rome, because, you know, there wasn't, you know, we didn't have North and South America yet or anywhere else. So the Christian West was really just Rome and the rest of the Roman Empire. But those are the big three breaks, right? Then, in the year 1274, at the Second Council of Lyon, we tried reaching out to some of these break-off groups, the Eastern Orthodox, the Oriental Orthodox, the Assyrian Church of the East, all these different groups that had broken off, and invited them to return to communion with Rome and with the rest of the churches in communion with Rome. And many of them did. And anyways, that was really the beginning of what we call now the Eastern Churches of the Catholic Church, the Eastern churches that do recognize the Pope. And so I know this can be kind of confusing when you think about it, but perhaps one way to think about it is that you had many of these churches in the East that broke off from the Pope, and then you had some who came back, and now they're back under the Pope, and you have some that are still away. And the ones that came back, this was the nice thing about it, is when they were coming back, they, of course, were encouraged to keep their own traditions that had developed in those areas. And so that's why we have these other traditions that still exist to this day. But just a quick little aside, you know, the Holy Father, he was the Patriarch of Rome, the Bishop of Rome, but he was also the visible head of the entire one Holy Catholic and Apostolic Church. And so the way we understand it is your union or disunion with the Church of Christ can be visibly measured by your union or disunion with the Pope. I mean, that's ultimately what it comes down to, is do you recognize the successor of St. Peter, the Vicar of Christ on earth, or do you not? I mean, that's ultimately what it comes down to. And even to this day, we have, in the West, we have different splinter groups that don't recognize the Pope, and we have, and those ones are technically in schism, and you have others that recognize the Pope but think it's okay to disobey him, and all sorts of different confusing things there. But that's the great thing about being Catholic, is that, you know that you are Catholic if you are in communion with the Holy Father or not, you know, and if you're in communion with the Holy Father and I'm in communion with the Holy Father, then you and I are in communion with each other. I mean, that's how our communion is determined. Are we both in communion with the Vicar of Christ on earth? So yes, he is the Bishop of Rome, but not just of Rome. I mean, as the Prince of the Apostles, as the one apostle to whom Christ said specifically, "You are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church." And it's interesting because the word Peter means rock. He said basically, "You are rock, and on this rock I will build my church." So that's the great thing about being Catholic, is you have a way of visually measuring, if you will, visually determining, is this person in union with Rome or are they not? And that's why sometimes when you run into some of these Eastern churches and you're trying to figure out, are they Catholic or aren't they Catholic, a very simple question is, do you recognize the Pope of Rome? And the answer is either yes or no, you know? When many of these churches came back, one of the terms that was used was called the uniate churches, and so you'll sometimes still hear that word. You'll hear the uniate churches. We're also kind of discouraged to use that word because it had all sorts of connotations to it that we wanted to avoid. But basically, these were the ones from the East that came back into union with Rome and with everyone with whom Rome is in communion. But like I said before, they kept their traditions. They kept their rites. They kept many of their laws as well, and their own hierarchy. So what I want to get into now with the remaining time is I want to talk about some of the differences that you'll notice in the Eastern churches. One of the differences already that I mentioned is the law. And one of the big things that confuses people is in many of the Eastern traditions, their priests are married. And people find this confusing. They say, wait a minute, you're a Catholic priest? And it's like, yeah, but you're married. So are you Orthodox? No, I'm Catholic, you know? And there's some confusion, and especially, this was especially the case about 200 years ago when after the Roman Rite hierarchy was established in this country, mostly by the immigrants, when many of the Eastern Europeans started coming over and bringing their priests. Many Catholics saw them as Orthodox and didn't accept them as Catholic. And many of the Catholic bishops, even, there was a big issue, a big falling out, because this one Eastern Rite priest came over and he was married, and a whole bunch of people were scandalized. They thought, well, you must not be Catholic because you're married. You must be Orthodox. And he was Catholic, and there was some big debate that occurred between him and the Roman Rite bishop. So there's been a lot of friction, especially in this country, where they've come over after the Roman Rite came over. So that's part of their tradition, is that their priests can be married. Now, interestingly enough, their traditions do still hold celibacy in a high esteem, and that's why, for them, in their traditions, their bishops have to be celibate. Their bishops are only chosen from those priests who are celibate. So if you're an Eastern Rite priest and you're married, that means you're never going to become, you never can become a bishop. Most of their diocesan priests are married. Not all of them, but most of them are married. The ones that aren't married are usually the ones who are monks in the religious orders. And of course, if you're in a religious order, you can't also be having a wife and kids at home. So that kind of made sense that if you're in a religious order, you would be celibate. And that's why, to this day, most of the Eastern Rite bishops are all former monks. They were in a monastery. They were celibate priests. And when this diocese needed a bishop, the Pope said, okay, this guy's going to be the bishop. Now, it's much more complicated than that. They do all sorts of, you know, they check the guy out. They do all sorts of background checks and everything else. So that's one big thing. That's one noticeable thing, is that many of their priests are married. And I talked about celibacy, priestly celibacy, before in the talk that I did on the ministerial priesthood back in September. And I talked about how celibacy is a discipline, not a doctrine, which means that in theory it could change. Something like the ordination of women, and I talked about that in the September class as well, that's a doctrinal issue, and that's why that can't change. Something like clerical celibacy, that is disciplinary, which means in theory it could change, but at least in the Roman Rite, I personally don't think it's ever going to change, nor do I think it should. It's a great blessing to the Church. And the point I'm trying to make is that even the East does recognize that as well, because some people look at the East and they say, oh, look, they've got their stuff together. They recognize, you know, the changing times, and it's like, that's always been their tradition. They're not like ahead of the game or anything here. This has always been part of their tradition that their priests were married. In fact, they do still esteem celibacy among the, in the monastic life for the men and women, the monks and the nuns, and also their bishops. Another big difference is with the liturgy. Like I said before, that's one of the most visible expressions of some of the differences here. The first thing I would say is, their mass is actually called the Divine Liturgy, And so that can be sometimes confusing when you're looking at one of their bulletins and you're saying, well, what's your Mass schedule? And you'll just see these things like Divine Liturgy celebrated this and that. That's what the Mass is. It's what they call the Divine Liturgy. Because liturgy, I mean, like in the West, we talk about other types of liturgies as well. I mean, baptism is a type of liturgy. The breviary is a type of liturgy. You know, and that's, of course, morning prayer, evening prayer, night prayer, all those things. Those are all liturgies. Liturgy meaning it's a public prayer as opposed to a private devotion. Like the rosary is a private devotion. It's not liturgy. Morning prayer, evening prayer, night prayer, baptism, confirmation, Mass, those are all liturgies. Those are all public prayer, the prayer of the church, as opposed to private devotions. So they'll use those terms as well, but again, the Divine Liturgy, that's Mass. One of the other interesting things with the liturgy too, and this is, many of you have noticed some of my own Eastern inklings when it comes to the liturgy, the incense, yes. They use a lot of incense in the East. So, well, they understand the symbolism a little bit better, I think. Also, their thurible do have the bells on them, and that's why when I got a chance to get a thurible here, I said I want one with bells on it. It's smells and bells.
Did you tell everybody that you got 100% in incense?
I got an A+ in incensing at the seminary. No. another big thing are their use of icons, and that's why I brought some of the icons that I have hanging up on my walls in the rectory and in the office. The icon is, I guess the most basic way to explain it is the icon is in the East what the statue is in the West. In the West, coming out of Rome, again, the Roman Rite, and just as a quick little aside, one of the reasons why the Roman Rite is so big and the biggest of all of them is because it was associated with the Roman Empire. And so, of course, as the Roman Empire expanded, so too did the Roman Rite. And that's why, to this day, most Catholics are Roman Catholics. And that's why there's just that huge... That's why many Catholics have never even heard of these Eastern churches. But anyways, in Rome, of course, there was a lot of use of statues. That was part of the pagan worship. And so, of course, in the Christianity that developed in Rome, they too used statues, but understood it properly. You know, a statue of Mary or a statue of Joseph, you weren't worshiping them as you would in the Roman pagan religions, but they still kind of took those things and adapted it to Christianity. So that's why in the Roman Rite, we have so many use of statues, you know, and in fact, every church is supposed to have statues in it. That's why we have, you know, Mary and Joseph and Anne and Francis and Dominic and all the different, you know. But in the East, what they have are these things called icons, which are generally painted on wood. And if you go into an Eastern church, they're all over the place. They're all over the place. And they have icons for not just all the different saints, but they have icons for different events. So they'll have an icon showing like the baptism of Christ, or an icon showing the nativity, or an icon showing the resurrection, or an icon of the martyrdom of these 40 martyrs, you know, or different things. So different events sometimes as well. It's just saints. But the idea of an icon in the East is that these are not just sacred images. They're not just nice things to look at. There's a whole theology in the East, and they actually will call them windows into heaven, that an icon is a window into heaven. And there's a whole way in which the icons are painted. And in fact, they don't talk about an icon being painted. They say the icon was written by so-and-so. But the monks or the nuns who do these icons, there's a whole thing where they have to fast, and they have to go to confession, and they have to do all these different things before they can even sit down and begin doing the icon. And once the icon's done, then it's actually placed on the altar for the Divine Liturgy, and it receives the full blessing and everything else. And then and only then is it put up and used for public veneration. And you'll notice when you go into an Eastern church, they don't genuflect at the tabernacle. In fact, they don't genuflect at all. That's a Western thing. But they will go right up to the icons, and they'll bow, and they'll start kissing the icons. That's a big Eastern tradition. Whenever they walk into a church, they'll they'll bow before the icon, they'll cross themselves, and they'll kiss it. But the icon in the East is, again, it's not just a nice piece of wood. The idea is that you're looking into heaven. You're looking at this saint or this event in glory, in a sense. And so that's a big difference there, too. So I have some of them here. And there is a very particular way in which the icons are painted. They're not meant to look... what's the best word I want to use? They're not meant to look historically accurate. Probably not the best way of saying it. But they're not meant to be like a painting of the person. There's so much symbolism in the icons that if you look at these things, I mean, there have been entire books, thick books, written on each and every one of these icons. I mean, detailing every single detail, every use of color, every design, every little dot here and there, and why, you know, why Christ's sleeve has 12 buttons on it and not any more or less, and, you know, different colors and the different thing, everything. So there's a whole theology there of the icons. And in fact, one of the big things you'll notice when you walk into an Eastern church is what's called the iconostasis, which is basically what our altar rail used to be. You know, after the Second Vatican Council, one of the unfortunate things that happened was they got rid of these altar rails, which, you know, was, you know, only a few feet tall, but it was a visual representation. It was meant to be a visible representation of, you know, heaven and earth. And the priest was the one who would go back and forth. And when you were at Mass, you were watching heaven. You were looking at what was going on in heaven. And the priest, in the person of Christ, came from heaven to earth and would give you his own flesh and blood. I mean, there's so much more symbolism with an altar rail. And some people said, "Oh, it you know, it's clerical; it separates the priest from the laity." That wasn't the point. It wasn't. And sure, if you take that interpretation, then yeah, it's a bad thing. But that's not the point. That's not why it was there. In the East, they have a whole wall. You don't see what's going on at the altar. Period. It's very difficult, in fact. There's literally a wall, and it has doors that are only open at certain parts, and you see the ministers come out of one door, and they go in another door. And they come out of door and go through another door again. It's like those little clocks where the thing comes out and goes through one door around. And at a few points during the liturgy, the priest, and only the priest, walks through the center doors and will incense the people and turn around and incense the icons. But it's basically a whole wall made up of icons. And again, it's a symbol of entering into heaven, that, you know, you see all of these saints in glory. You are literally looking into heaven. So there's that. Two last things, some of the differences. One other thing is in Christian initiation, we receive the three sacraments of initiation at three different times. In the East and in the early church in the West as well, they were all received at once. When a baby was baptized, or an adult, didn't matter who, when anyone was baptized, that's when they were also confirmed, which they call chrismation. They don't call it confirmation, but it's the same sacrament. And they received First Holy Communion. And in fact, again, to this day, the East continues that tradition. When a baby is baptized, they baptize it, the priest confirms the baby, and they have a little spoon that they take a little bit of the precious blood and they put it on the baby's tongue and communicate the baby and give the baby First Holy Communion. And the idea, of course, is that, same in the West, you're not fully initiated in the church until you've received all three sacraments of initiation. You are a member of the church by virtue of your baptism, and that's why even Protestants who have a valid baptism, but of course they don't have a valid confirmation because that requires a valid priesthood and they don't have that, but they do have valid baptism because anyone can baptize. Even a baptized Protestant is still a member of the church, but they're not fully initiated because they haven't received confirmation, they haven't received First Holy Communion. So in the East, it's all done at once. In the West, we started pushing them off until later, and so now we have this practice of, you know, First Holy Communion at second grade and confirmation at eighth grade, and even that's kind of messed up a little bit because Holy Communion was supposed to be the pinnacle, not confirmation. It was supposed to be baptism, confirmation, communion. And there's a whole reason, I'm not going to get into now, why that was reversed. But so that's one difference. And the other thing about that, too, is that every single time after a baby was baptized, because they would receive confirmation of First Holy Communion, every single time thereafter, you know, the baby would receive communion again. So a lot of times in Eastern churches, you'll see a mom carrying up a baby, and the priest will give the mom communion, give the baby communion. And sometimes when people see that, they think, my God, the priest just gave the baby communion? Like, what's going on? Well, it's because the baby's already received First Holy Communion, they're receiving it again. And they receive Holy Communion the whole rest of their lives, you know, even as an infant. The other thing to watch out for is when Eastern Rite Catholics come to a Roman church, their babies are allowed to receive Holy Communion. So that can scandalize some people here sometimes when I know that they're Eastern Rite, and so I give a piece of communion to the baby. People are like, like, what just happened? It's like, don't worry, this is legit, it's allowed. They're Catholic, they're allowed to receive our sacraments. So that's another difference too. So the last thing I'm going to say, because I'm at 30 minutes right now, is ecumenism, just something about ecumenism and reunions. So there have been and continue to be all sorts of efforts at reuniting after a lot of these splintered groups. And one hopes that the Eastern churches of the Catholic Church are kind of the bridge to bringing the other ones back into communion with Rome. But as history has kind of shown us, in some cases they've actually been more of a stumbling block than a bridge, because sometimes when you sit down and try to do ecumenical dialogues, one of the accusations that's been made against the Catholic Church is that we stole those people from the Orthodox. You know, sometimes the Orthodox will say, you have to, you know, before we even sit down and talk about ecumenism, you have to give us our Eastern Catholics back, you know. And it's like, there's a reason why they're not Orthodox. They want to be in communion with Rome. That's a good thing, you know. But so sometimes they see it as we've stolen their people. When you say, look, this was their free choice to come back and to be Catholic, to be under the Pope. And that can be kind of, that can be, like I said, sometimes more of a stumbling block. But the good thing about it is I think that it can show them that we're not out to take over their church, you know. If you go to an Ethiopian Catholic Divine Liturgy and an Ethiopian Orthodox Divine Liturgy, they look identical. The only difference is that this one's praying for the Ethiopian Catholic bishop and the Pope, and this one's praying for the Ethiopian Orthodox bishop, and they don't have a Pope. But that's it. I mean, the language is the same, the rite is the same, their disciplines are the same, married priests, their own canon laws, their own hierarchy, their own structure, their everything, except this one eventually falls under the Pope and this one doesn't. And so I like to think that the Eastern churches of the Catholic Church can kind of be that bit of a bridge to say, hey, look, we're not out to take you over and to suppress your liturgies and to make you conform to ours or anything like that. Another problem with ecumenism, though, is since many of those churches broke off 1,000 years ago or 1,500 years ago, there have been other developments that they don't accept. And so, for instance, you know, to use a contemporary example, the Catholic Church, for instance, is unabashedly pro-life. And this is just one example I'm using because, you know, it's still fresh in my memory. We had the big March for Life on Monday. That's not the case with many of the Orthodox. You know, part of the problem, of course, is they don't have one central authority. You know, every Orthodox bishop is kind of free to do what they want, and there is no one authority. And so if you go to an Orthodox and say, well, what do you all believe on the issue of abortion or on the issue of the death penalty or on the issue of this or that or whatever, you're going to get different answers. There's no one authority to say this is what we believe. And that's a problem, I think. That's one of the nice things about having a central authority. So you'll find some Orthodox that are pro-choice. You'll find some Orthodox that don't believe in the Immaculate Conception of the Blessed Mother, or they have a different way of understanding it, and all sorts of other theological kind of developments that have occurred. Some they've kind of gone in different directions. So. Those are some of the stumbling blocks that kind of exist to this day, but certainly something worth praying for are the reunion of the Orthodox churches with the Catholic Church. But I'll say this last, is it is. It looks like it's going in the right direction. The Holy Father has been meeting with the Patriarch of Constantinople, who is generally considered a figurehead among Orthodox, but like I just said before, I mean, he has no real authority over anyone else but his own diocese. So it looks like it's looking up, but again, something worth praying for. And the other thing too is because many of these breaks early on were over smaller issues or over misunderstandings or whatever, at least we do still recognize each other's sacraments, you know. And so when I go to an Orthodox church, for instance, even though they're not in communion with Rome, I will still genuflect, even though, again, that's a Western thing to do, and they don't do that in the East. I mean, they have a valid blessed sacrament. They have a valid priesthood. I still call their priests father, even though technically they're in schism. So that's the good thing, is at least we do still recognize their sacraments, because many of those issues, again, were jurisdictional, as opposed to, like, in the Protestant churches, many of those were doctrinal. And so, like I just said, you know, the only valid sacrament they have is baptism, and potentially marriage, but they don't even believe that that is a sacrament. So so there's that issue as well. But so pray for that reunion there. And with that, I will wrap up. And again, if you need to head out, feel free to head out, pick up a book, or check out the icons. And of course, as always, if you have questions, I will stick around and answer as many questions as you have.